one.
I found out what my Harry Potter house is on Pottermore.
That's also what a good is it? One.
You're total Slytherin.
It was Slytherin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Wonkcast. Thank you for joining us again. We are a podcast as an extension of the student-run Policy Perspectives, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School for Public Policy and Public Administration here at George Washington University. Today, I am joined by my co-hosts, Eli Richmond.
Hello.
And Kat Lundy.
Hi.
And we are joined today by Megan Mattson, here to talk to us about evidence-based management. Megan, welcome.
Hey, y'all. It's good to be here.
Good to have you, finally.
Yeah. Longtime fan. I want to actually start with a confession on this topic. My confession is that I'm a leadership nerd. I read this stuff for fun, right? Like when we're talking about what do I read at night, what do I enjoy just doing in my spare time, this is it. So that's my confession that I want to preface talking about this topic with. I absolutely love this stuff.
And another confession, Megan has been the leader of Policy Perspectives for this past year.
Amazing leader.
Amazing leader. So we have had the good fortune of experiencing some of her leadership skills, but now we get to hear a discussion about leadership.
Well, exactly. We can talk about where some of that comes from, right? Like, what am I trying to draw upon? But yeah, so I'm really excited to talk about this topic, and I think it's great, too, to talk about more of the public administration side. We get to talk a lot about policy, but that's a different warehouse under the Trachtenberg School that we don't get to talk about as much, mainly because it's harder to talk about, right? When we're administering policies, it's more about how are we actually choosing to administer them, what decisions are being made. It's less in the news and a little bit less fun sometimes, but I think still important.
Yeah, it does feel like sometimes the numbers behind the policy often get more of the media attention than, okay, who's actually sitting down and like developing the strategic plan for implementing that policy.
Right, and we only hear about leadership when it goes badly.
So. Yes.
I feel like we've started to see a little bit more of a focus on this in recent years, hearing rhetoric about how personal is policy and how important it is to get the right people in the important jobs, but it's definitely less relatable for a lot of people if they haven't directly had that experience of working in government or administering policy. They might not necessarily know how to relate to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, and a lot of people get thrown into a job and their goal isn't necessarily to be a boss in their career,
mm-hmm.
but you become it at a certain point. You're given a team to manage because that's just where, you know, you end up. And it is an art. Leadership is an art, but it's also a science. There's over 250 years worth of research about what makes a good boss and manager out there. So there's a lot that we can draw upon.
250 years, that's a very specific number. What would you say is the start of that 250 years?
A lot of it's been changing. So the start of it had more to do with what makes a good leader. And so the beginning of it, right, we're looking at things like if someone's tall, are they a good leader? And physical characteristics. And obviously the research has advanced a lot from that because those things can take into account, what makes someone perceive someone as a leader, but there's obviously a lot more that goes into the equation. So thankfully I can report we've come a long way from that, which is good.
Well, especially I think also there's been a larger wave in the practice of exercising leadership at all levels of an organization. It's not just how is the boss a leader, the person who is, you know, has power over others. It's also how do the line workers in an agency how can they exercise leadership? How can leadership be exercised between peers in a more horizontal organization model?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot that goes into job satisfaction with that too, right? It's not just how are you treated by your boss and what's that relationship like? There's a lot more that goes into it.
Great. So is there a particular topic involving leadership you wanted to come to? Specifically, I think it's interesting that we're using the phrase evidence-based management. That makes it sound like we got a little bit of science behind this.
Yeah, so I think it's useful to dig into how can you specifically try to use evidence when you're being a good manager. And it was helpful for me. I have to give a really big shout out when I'm talking about this topic to Dr. Jasmine Johnson here. She teaches managing public organizations at the Trachtenberg School. And she really laid this out for me, which I thought it was helpful. There's all these different types of evidence when we're thinking about leadership. So for the first one of those is your practitioner judgment and expertise. So that's what most people are drawing upon when they're a boss. In that, you can pick apart is something a gut feeling or an expert feeling. Like, do you know about this from your experience because you've worked in it for 10 years, or you just kind of have a hunch? You can pick that apart. The second type of evidence is the local context. So you have to consider that, you know, one experience that you may have at a small nonprofit could be totally irrelevant in a huge bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to take into account stakeholder input. That's actually evidence. What are people saying? A stakeholder being anyone who has power or interest in the program you're working in. And then the last is academic research, which is out there, studies about what makes good management. So the practice of evidence-based management is explicitly thinking about those four steps and taking a pause when you're in a managerial role to say, what's actually happening? What could be the impetus behind that? What's making this happen? And then what types of evidence can I look to as to how to solve this problem as a manager?
This is just in terms of interpersonal or conflicts within workers in the office, or not achieving goals or objectives in the actual work you're doing?
That's a great question. Absolutely any sort of issue. So organizational or personal, among your team, your colleagues, anything you're in charge of managing.
So can you give us some examples of this? Do you have any solid examples in your either your personal experience or things that came up in some like research when like researching organizations or leadership that's come up in academic literature?
Yeah, what's a good, there's so many different, I think good examples of using this type of research are, we can look to larger scale organizational examples or personal examples. So I found it helpful to be able to point to research, for example, in a managerial setting. When you have to talk to someone in the workplace, it can be really difficult to say, I want you to change your behavior for so-and-so reason. And for me, it's been useful to say, I can point to academic research that actually shows that type of behavior can cause this type of reaction, which is harmful for a workplace.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a useful example on the micro scale of using this kind of lens.
So like going into specific behaviors, often I've when it comes to talking about running an organization or running a group of people, what's really been emphasized to me a lot is getting people on board where everyone feels empowered in their contributions to a team or an organization. So it's one thing to lead by having people, by running an organization where people are really passionate about whatever topic your organization tackles. It could be you work in microfinance, maybe you run a nonprofit that helps like resettle escaped North Koreans. You can lead people, you can get people's interest by having a really engaging topic that people want to be a part of, but it's also how within those practices and how you manage those people, do they feel excited about the work they're doing? And whether or not they're given some leeway in having a conversation with their leader about like, okay, what are my values? How do those values align with the organization I'm working with? Can you speak anything to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this actually has a buzzword. I don't know if y'all want to try to guess it.
Being visionary?
Drum roll, please. It's called transformational leadership.
Oh, hey.
So there's more research on this, and it's gaining traction. But that's one intentional way that people are actually trying to lead, is leading by transforming an organization and through vision
mm-hmm.
and through leadership. But this point that you made about employees, right, and like the role that you have as an employee with your boss in talking about your position is really big. So when we're thinking about employee motivation, like what makes you motivated at your job, the research is largely mixed about what makes people motivated or not. A lot of that's dependent on your person. So for example, we can get into a discussion about pay, if that interests you guys. But basically, pay is useful for attracting people initially, and then less useful later on. And the research is mixed about like pay for performance, if that actually makes a big input. But one largely backed up way that we know motivates people at work, which increases job satisfaction, which makes people less likely to leave a job, which is also big from a resource standpoint if you're an organization, is goal setting. So this is one of the research proven methods that actually works to motivate employees. So when we think about goal setting, there's a couple of things that have to happen. The buzzword is that your goals should be SMART. So SMART means that they're specific, they're measurable, they're achievable, relevant, and time bound. Basically trying to make sure that you can actually meet this goal that you set for yourself, that it's not vague. And this should be a goal that's set by both the employee and the and their boss together working on this goal. It's also not enough to just set a goal. You have to have feedback on it. Are you actually meeting that? Are you actually working toward that? So that comes with a managerial role too, is that you need to be able to help people check in with whether or not they're meeting their goal. But this is pretty big, and it's a research-proven method that helps people be motivated at work and feel job satisfaction, which is really big.
I know one thing, and I don't know if this plays into what you were just talking about, but for me and some of the other jobs I used to work at, I would never fully understand my role in the big picture, and I would get lost a lot of the time with my boss. I knew what I was doing was helping everyone else, and it did have a big picture purpose, but feeling appreciated in maybe my small part in the big picture sometimes got lost in the noise of the other people. I used to be a paralegal, so the attorneys definitely got the pat on the backs for briefs, or you got this in on time, or that was an amazing, you know, argument you developed. Meanwhile, I feel like the behind the scenes people who feel a little bit more less noticed, I don't want to say that we want more, but we also like having that idea that our work is appreciated as much as everyone else's.
Absolutely. And there's actually a difference between organizational satisfaction and job satisfaction. So you can be super satisfied with the organization that you're working for, but still miserable in your personal job. And that makes a really big difference.
I once heard an anecdote about, because what many people know is that when you look at, so when speaking about leadership and satisfaction, a wonderful tool is the Best Places to Work in Government tool, created by the Partnership for Public Service, ranks the agencies in the government based on best to not as best places to work. And it has different rating indexes for different things. So do people feel like they're supported at work? How do they feel about innovation? Are they compensated well for the work that they do? And I remember when I was learning about this, I was hearing about how NASA tends to score really high all the time.
Oh, I bet.
Because it's NASA, you know, you send things to outer space.
Yeah.
But an anecdote that's tied with that is talking about how even the people that aren't the rocket scientists feel their work is relevant. There's a story of an evaluator was around NASA and asked a janitor what his job was. Now, a janitor, you know, cleans the halls, cleans the restrooms, and the guy said, "I'm helping put a man on the moon."
That's awesome.
And you know, it's being able to see sort of how what he did in this one part played an important role of making sure that NASA itself operated appropriately and achieved its final goals. I think this really plays well with what you were talking about how aligning people with their missions. And aligning people with the mission of the organization so they feel that job satisfaction in their role in the organization. And I think a lot of that comes down to articulating what the product is you're going towards, or articulating what the mission is for many leaders.
Absolutely. And I think there's also a difference. We could, you know, debate to what extent this exists, but public versus private sector motivations are going to be a little bit different, and I think these things can come into more of a play in public sector and nonprofits for sure.
When you were talking about, I want to go back to payment. I remember specifically in that we covered this in microeconomics for public administration, where we were talking about how there's studies that have been done that show a limit to the utility you get out of employees based on paying them. Mm-hmm. And the curve, it shoots up as you start to pay people more, and then there seems to peak and it starts to go down again, where suddenly you're paying more but you're actually getting less from people.
Mm-hmm. What's the tipping point around, do you remember?
The tipping point, I mean, the exact number I don't recall. The tipping point seems to be somewhere around where you've compensated people enough and they can live comfortably, and then suddenly the more you pay them, the more they feel how heavily important their job suddenly, you know, it raises the chances of like having an anxiety attack. Like, oh my God, my job is worth, you know, $500 an hour. I need to do this job right. And then suddenly people start, you know, when you start becoming really self-conscious about what your worth is in relation to your work, you start messing up. You become very self-conscious about it.
Interesting. That's not the mechanism I would have expected. I would have expected it's more like as people start earning a wage they feel comfortable with, they feel like they don't need to do their best work and get promoted anymore, so that they kind of, you know, can mm-hmm. relax and be more average.
Just to explain that more, so the main research that was done on this, I recall, was based on offering financial prizes for people that competed in different activities. So it was things like throwing tennis balls into a bucket. And if Pete, you know, the more tennis, there was a certain thing where if you get these many tennis balls, you get this much per tennis ball. But if you start to get even more tennis balls, we'll start paying you this much. Or it might be that you randomly spun a wheel and it would tell you how much you'd get if you were able to accomplish a certain amount of tennis balls. And the people that got the really high reward offer up front, if they achieved the goal, they were less likely to achieve the goal because there was more on the line. You know, if someone says, like, I'll give you $10 if you can do a three-point shot, you know, whatever, you're going to shoot, but you're going to be a little more relaxed, you're probably going to do it more because it's fun. But then if someone says, I will pay you $500,000 if you can make that three-point shot, suddenly you might not be playing your best because so much is on the line and you have to get it right and you are so focused. And then we all know how those stories work.
If I could ask another question about pay, I know it's been my experience in, like, private versus public, that sometimes when there seems to be a problem or any time I've been disgruntled or upset about something that's going on at work, my boss's immediate reaction was, do you need more money? Mm-hmm. Without actually solving any of the issues that I was coming to him about. So is there anything about that sort of leadership style?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, there are different things that motivate different people, but largely, that doesn't seem to be a retention mechanism. You tend to save for other reasons once you're in the job. So your boss may want to look at some other evidence if they want to use evidence-based management.
Former boss, not current boss. I love my boss right now.
One other thing on pay is that research does say that it matters to us when we perceive that our pay isn't fair. So if we think that somebody else is getting more for the same amount of work, or if we feel that we're putting in more work, but we're actually being paid less than we used to be paid, that makes us unhappy at work.
Megan, I hope this isn't too tangential, but when we're talking about evidence-based management, mostly so far we've been talking about what the research says about the best practices of treating employees. Is this going to start verging into evidence about particular employees and using that to base your management styles? It's something I wonder about a lot because employers are starting to get so much data on their employees as a lot of work starts to go to the computer and you can start seeing exactly how long people are taking on individual tasks. Is that something that's going to start cropping up in management styles more?
The more dystopian question, right?
Employee metrics.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So I think about using evidence more as just deliberately using research or thinking mm-hmm. through things as you're making managerial decisions. But this is becoming a bigger thing in workplaces, right? Where we're starting to like track our employee movements and we're having a lot more data on people. That's a great question. I think it's more useful as a manager to use evidence in things like how are my employees' personalities suited so I can better tailor tasks to them, and thinking about things like that, like how can I effectively communicate with people. I think that type of data, so to speak, is just knowing the people that you're working with is really valuable. I don't see as much utility in getting that nitpicky with other metrics, but maybe there are contexts where it makes more sense, right? If you're running some sort of like pizza delivery shop and your goal isn't to make everybody happy, but it's just to produce pizza, that could make more sense than where it's really hard to hire people and you need to retain your staff.
Should that always be part of a manager's goal, making sure that employees are happy, right?
To me, yes.
Okay.
But I would say that's part of my personal leadership style. Okay.
I had heard about how with UPS, they've been doing that kind of individual employee metrics for a while now, where because of computers in the car and they'll have like some kind of iPad or something that they mark off that they delivered something, they're keeping track of, you know, how long does it take for this person to drop a package off at a doorway? What's the average of dropping off packages at that doorway? So I think like for tasks that are a little bit more about biomechanics and how efficiently you use your body, I can definitely see that. Potentially that could be, and that could totally, I could see that being very stressful for employees.
Right.
I wouldn't want to do that at all.
I this is one thing I wonder about a lot in terms of management, because I know we're starting to get this capability, but is it actually productive to use it that way? I mean, I know in my job, you guys know what Trello is?
Mm-hmm.
It's a task management software, basically, so you can coordinate like what tasks are on the docket for a team and like assign it to different people.
We have Asana, is that the same thing?
Yes, it's very
okay.
Similar. So because with those programs, right, your employer has information like what's the average time it takes this person to complete one of their Trello cards. And like, so I know my bosses have that information. Like they mention it once or twice, but they're like very, I think it's like they don't really want to mention it that much. And I see why, because you could like really stress out your employees, like, you know, you have this it's not something you can turn off that you're being tracked that way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a constant watchful eye of the employer looking looking over your shoulder. Yeah, I do wonder how if that's not kind of productive eventually.
It's super interesting you bring that up. We actually just started using Asana. It's similar software for
mm-hmm.
tasks. I do campaign work, but most of the stuff we do is more like we don't have deadlines, right? And we can be very creative in the way we approach certain projects or even problems that just pop up and we need to solve things. So Asana, it's great for us, but at the same time, I guess we have the flexibility of knowing that if a project comes up late, it's because we all collectively forgot to either cross it off, or maybe it's just not the right software for our team. But we are actually still trying to find ways to manage this giant campaign most effectively, just so things don't fall through the cracks. And we appreciate software like that, but we're also not stressing people out like, oh, you didn't do this on time, or this
yeah.
is late on your task list or whatever it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're great. And I mean, if you have a team that's trying to use the metrics it's giving you in order to produce the best product, great. But you know, that occasional bad manager does have a capability to be like, okay, well, it's taking this person the longest to complete these campaigns, so.
It sounds to me like it's a matter of how you treat the data.
For sure.
Like any kind of, like if you're doing research, you get information on something, you can spin it one way, spin it another. And I think that if I had, you know, if my employer came up to me and said, you know, we have metrics on like the time it takes between when you're assigned a project and when the project is done, and it seems like you're, you know, during this time of the year, it's a little bit slower for you. Is there anything going on that you would need assistance with? You know, there's being helpful about it with the information and
mm-hmm.
using it as, and really focusing it on, you know, as your leader, I want to make sure that you are able to develop and do your, and perform your best, you know, that's best for you. You know, so let's talk about this, keep it a dialogue versus dictating down to people, your numbers are down.
Yeah. And that goes into these other things we're talking about, right? Like emotional intelligence. It's
right.
a very emotionally intelligent thing to stress your employees out about data, right? But it is emotionally intelligent to say, hey, I noticed this, like, do you want to talk about something? Or how can we set a goal toward this? Also, what's interesting is on the flip side, we can look at public, like, positive use of data.
Mm-hmm.
And that has mixed effects, too. Some people really react well to that, like employee of the month and your photo is on the wall, and some people don't. So there's not a universally secure method. Some people, it's much better to like thank them in private for their work, and some people publicly it works better.
So I'm from like the Smithfield area of Virginia, not Smithfield itself, but there's a lot of pork processing plants there. And one of the, an old friend who was getting an MBA at William & Mary working for Smithfield was trying to think of an incentive program for people that, you know, basically are checking sausages and bacon all day, and how do you motivate them without just an employee of the month? So they tried instituting the red hat. If your hat is red and everyone else is white, then you know that was the person who did the most things that day. And so they were trying to brainstorm ways to create incentive, or I don't know, a congratulations pat on the back for these employees.
And it's, there's such a quality difference between doing it with like a more, you know, there are some tasks where what you, what the quality you need from that person is to, is consistency and, you know, efficiency, versus if someone's in more of like a designer role or overview enterprise, like program management position, you need that person to be more innovative, and in how you you need to have a reward system that best suits that. It can't be one shoe fits all feet, right? Mm-hmm. I did not pick the right kind of analogy there.
I think these programs have to feel, most importantly, sincere from the organization, and it's really easy for them to not. If your organization cuts bonuses one year but gives you a gift basket, you're not going to see that gift basket as, you know, motivational, right?
Right.
Or sincere.
Actually, I was going to ask about the data in terms of what, maybe this is more what makes a good workplace, but is there any data out, or maybe I've seen it, of forcing people to take vacations from work?
That's super interesting. I haven't read that much about this. What do you guys think?
You've seen it?
I'm not.
Yeah, okay, I'm not crazy.
It's in the Silicon Valley world, because you know you have a lot of employees that are workaholics and just don't want to take vacation, either because they don't want to be separated from their work, or because there's like a social pressure from other employees to continue working. Amazon has that problem with their insane corporate culture that's been reported on a little bit.
Vacation's been stigmatized.
Right, yeah. And so some Silicon Valley companies had started instituting unlimited vacation days to try to get at this. Just, you know, you can do, you know, you don't have 15, you have as many as you want. And I think they found that that made people take fewer vacations, because that social pressure to not take vacations rose even more so.
So instead they switched it back to a use it or lose it system, right? Where it's like you have 15 days, and if you don't use them, they're going to be gone. And suddenly it reversed it, right?
Yeah, well, I think some people have done that. And then I think it was Netflix. I need to check my source on that. But I think Netflix put in place a policy that says you have to take 15 vacation days during the year.
I think when given the choice, a lot of science does say that people want the vacation over a bonus. That seems to be a trend.
Or get a bonus and a vacation.
What's the ideal world?
But especially for people that are interested in becoming in working in either nonprofit work, or basically working in organizations that are mission driven. This is often a lot of nonprofits, or working for a government agency where it's not about making a profit; it's about providing a service or creating a certain product. Often in those circumstances, you don't have like the flexibility of like a corporate structure where we can always offer more money to people. And so that's when leaders are often tasked with trying to be more creative about how you can make sure people feel good about what they're doing, and to make sure that they, you know, pay-wise, either way, it feels right. Megan, you were mentioning about how it's important that the pay feels fair compared to the amount of work. And I know that often sometimes, so this is where sometimes it affects policy, or at least the workings of government. Sometimes an agency, you know, you might have had a bunch of people retire, and it can take a while to hire people. So during that time, those that are left have extra work to do. They're not getting, you can't pay, there's no really a mechanism to pay them more to do that. So you have to find other ways of like relieving that, hiring people as fast as you can, or coming up with like a different project schedule to accommodate the fact that you have less hands on deck.
Yeah, I think that goes back to communication is the biggest thing, and the best way to find out what sort of reward and incentive is going to work for your employee is probably to ask them. which makes sense, right? But a lot of times we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard too, because especially in the public sector, you might not have the tools that they want,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, it's hard to figure out. It's embarrassing to then say as a manager, what do you want? And then you can't give the person that reward, and they're working really hard.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably a big problem in the public sector, right? Because you have very strict limitations about what you're allowed to do for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's specific mandates on how agencies are allowed to run compensation.
Yeah, and even things like parties, and you know, that's all paid for by employees and not built mm-hmm. into budgets, because it comes from taxpayer money, so it makes sense. But
the taxpayers yeah. won't pay for the pizza.
That's what we're saying.
Well, if you guys are interested, we can also talk a little bit about leadership advice. I have an exercise if you want, because I love this stuff.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So I want you guys to think about, which is pretty convenient because we're doing this right now, think about sitting around a table of 10 people, but every chair is full, unlike ours. So listeners, you know, you guys can't see that, but there's just a couple of us at this big table. So you're at this table, and then someone announces to you the first pair of people, where there's one person sitting and one person behind them, gets $10,000. What do you do?
I grab you and I just put you behind me so that you're standing up and we're the first pair of people.
Super interesting. What do y'all do?
I worry about redundancy of effort and just stay put. Yeah, maybe I'll motion people around me, but I'm going to stay seated.
So it's $10,000, right?
That's all you get, is you're sitting down and someone says you get $10,000, the first pair of people. There's somebody sitting and somebody's behind them.
The pair get the $10,000. But it's 10 people around the table?
Mm-hmm.
If people haven't jumped out of their seats by the time they make that announcement, I might say, would you all like to be guaranteed to walk away today with $1,000?
That's interesting. Wow. We had a good variety of answers here. I hope if you're listening, you got to think about, you know, your answer too. So mine is that I would turn to somebody next to me and say split, and then I would jump behind them. Like the minute I got the yes. This says a lot about your leadership style.
Aggressively.
Yeah, you have more of an aggressive style.
The listeners can't see it, but I literally grabbed Megan's arm as if I was going to pull her behind me.
Yeah, so it says a little bit, right? Like, this is just one small exercise, but if you're a more aggressive or less aggressive leader, a more submissive person. I'm a little bit more submissive by nature, so I stood behind somebody. Like, that's more of my style, right? But there's so many of these tricks and tests and things that you can take to learn more about yourself, which I think is really helpful to, you know how you lead and know how you work on a team and these types of attributes. The more that you know about yourself, the more you can communicate about your communication skills, what works for you, what doesn't work for you, and play to your strengths.
That wasn't a strength, because I am not a strong person, so getting Megan up would have been actually a little hard.
Hey, if I'm submissive, maybe it would have worked.
Well, hopefully I would have been convincing enough for everyone to agree to just split the 10,000, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure what that says about your style.
Consensus-driven.
Yeah. Transformational, if you will.
Transformational, if you will. Let me articulate for all of you a mission that we all get $1,000.
Yeah, or you're the prisoner in the prisoner's dilemma who decides not to talk.
So also on this, does any of you guys know your Myers-Briggs?
No, the MPAs, I think they had to take
it's
that.
True. They make us.
Yeah,
they make us.
Yeah,
they
and MPPs who didn't
I have taken my languages of love test.
Oh, that's a good one. I don't know how much that relates to leadership, but that is a good one.
First off, Myers-Briggs is wonderful. I think it's important that people don't take it too literally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. These are all tools.
It's a tool. It's very
not
helpful.
Yeah.
The one thing I would never do is I would never like sit everyone down, make them take it, and then label them with whatever their Myers-Briggs letter is. And actually, Megan, could you explain to our listeners real quick what Myers-Briggs is?
Yeah, so Myers-Briggs is one of the older personality tests. Got a lot of backing. There's of course other different personality tests, but it's old and somewhat tried and true, but of course there's a lot of controversy with it, like we were getting into. And then the characteristics are you're one of each of those categories, and if you sit down and take this test, which usually you have to pay for the official, but there's a lot of spin-offs, It tells you to what extent you're on each of these sort of scales.
And then you can...
The world's very first BuzzFeed quiz.
Yes. Yes, I remember taking it and I came out as a extrovert, intuitive, feeling, judging, which meant, according to the Star Wars version of the test, I was a Princess Leia.
Oh, I see that.
That's yeah.
I forget my Star Wars, but I'm almost the same. I'm an INFJ, though, not an ENFJ.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting topic, though, on introversion, extroversion, and leadership settings. One of my favorite books is called Quiet by Susan Cain, and it's all about how to be a powerful introverted leader. Mm. So there's a lot in the media of, like, sort of when we're thinking about the first part of research, right, and what makes a good leader, like somebody who's tall and who speaks a lot. And extroversion plays along with those things, right, what we expect a good manager and leader to be. But sometimes it's not what an organization needs. Or there's a lot of power also in being introverted and listening to your team and acting on things later and thinking about them. So that's been useful for me. But again, right, it's with all these tools what ends up working for you.
Going back to the idea of how you can be a leader at any level of your organization, it's also, you know, your skill set or the title you have does not dictate whether or not someone is the leader and someone isn't. And often, people, I feel like that's kind of the underlining stereotype of the master in public administration studier versus someone who gets their master in public policy. Someone, there becomes this, it becomes this dichotomy of like one person is the policy wonk, the other person is the administration wonk. And really, at the end of the day, these are going to be peers with complementary skill sets that are going to lead to a successful agency, nonprofit, organization.
Absolutely.
So Megan, you prompted us with wanting to bring in stories of worst,
yes.
Worst bosses.
Your best and worst boss
best
experiences.
And worst.
So I remember I did a year of AmeriCorps, and midway through my year, we got a new CEO, and this was a CEO who I guess was really into all those like businessy buzzword team building exercises, and he had this like one system he kept referring to, and he made us go through dozens of these meetings and workshops, and to the point where we weren't talking about what our organization did anymore. We were just talking about team building like totally abstractly.
I mean, I love these things, but that's a little far.
I eventually learned that his brother was the one who created the organizational structure he kept referring to, so it was not a super great creation.
So I'll mention mine at my old firm that I used to work at. It felt kind of like we had two bosses, and one was the good cop and one was the bad cop, where the bad cop would come in and just really talk you down about how you messed something up, but then he was quickly followed by the good cop who would tell you, don't worry, you're doing a good job. And so anxiety was just constantly all over the place.
Back when I worked in theater, I was working as a carpenter for a theater company. And what happened was, it was a bizarre circumstance where the artistic director of the company was also the technical director. So the person who's supposed to be doing the big enterprise thinking was also doing the shop drawings for the scenery and like leading carpenters on how to build things. And this was for a fairly large company where that shouldn't be the case. I had a circumstance where I had this guy who was supervising us. He was overworked because he had to be in three places at once all the time. He didn't actually, despite the titles he had given himself, he didn't actually know what he was doing as the technical director in terms of like actually thinking ahead of time what our material needs were going to be and how he was going to use the team of carpenters when we showed up every day. And also, because he didn't have that plan, it also meant that any suggestions would throw his decisions on what we were going to do back and forth, so there wasn't a clear agenda or a clear idea of what the finished product would be or how we would actually reach it. So it led to sort of this circumstance where there were a lot of times we were just kind of standing around scratching our heads going like, I don't get it. And then he'd get angry that we weren't doing anything. It's like, well, what do you want us to do? I was very glad to be done to get my paycheck and be done with that build at the end of that week.
I bet. These all speak so much into as to what we need as employees, right? Like, I'm hearing really different things in all of these stories. My bad boss story, so to speak, I call it an anti-mentor story because I think there's a lot we can learn in these types of scenarios about how not to lead and how not to manage. And it's important that, especially as young people, we don't forget these things later. But my anti-mentor, and they had good mentor moments too. Just a lot of yelling in the workplace, a lot of putting people on edge. This was in a very low stakes work environment where none of our work was that time sensitive. And at one point they came out of their office and said, if people are gonna leave around here, that's just the way it's gonna be. And that's hard to work under, right? Like, it's just really difficult.
Yeah.
But another thing that stands out to me is that good leaders don't have one specific style. You have to match whatever's happening in your organization or the circumstance. So that's going to call for different things at different times. So part of being a good leader is, providing your team with the tools they need and matching where your team is at. And that's going to change. You have to be willing to adapt. Maybe the key thing to think about is intention. Just really intending to be there for your team, whatever that means. And doing your due diligence, not getting too set in your ways.
Well, also, I mean, if you want to be there for your employees, making sure you've managed yourself so that you can be there for them. I'm sure there's plenty of other stories we may have of, like, the boss who, like, it doesn't have their own personal workday organization together, and as a result, they are touch and go when it comes to communication, touch and go with being able to be there, be present to provide whatever feedback or like whatever information you need from them, or even that kind of, sometimes you need that pat on the back and they're just not there. So that happens.
I'm gonna steal an analogy that an old friend once used when I was trying to adjust to sort of a leadership position at the old firm, and he was talking about there's a difference between Air Force and Marines. Air Force is full of checklists. Wings go, aviation go, navigation go, and there's all this stuff you have to do before you can take off and start a mission. Marines have the mindset of, let's plan for 70, knowing that 30% of whatever mission we're on is going to go to crap. Or it's going to not turn out the way we want. If we waited until 100% to move on something, we'll never start the project. And so his advice to me was always going with the 70-30 plan, don't wait on 100. And so that was his leadership style, and that always stuck with me, is that there's always going to be something that goes wrong. Don't plan for that, just plan for the 70% that you can get right. And I've kind of always liked that way of thinking when it comes to management.
I really like that. One thing that stuck with me is that you have a voice in the workplace, whatever that is, and that you can make a difference.
Is there anything else, Megan, you wanted to talk to us about leadership?
I don't think so. We're all ready to get out there and be good bosses, good leaders.
Oh, wait, I just thought of an amazing Napoleon Bonaparte quote. Hold on. If you build an army of 100 lions and their leader is a dog, in any fight, the lions will die like a dog. But if you build an army of 100 dogs and their leader is a lion, all the dogs will fight like a lion.
Love it.
Be a lion.
Be a lion.
Thanks so much, y'all.
Thanks so much for being here. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining us on Wonkcast.
Thanks for coming to GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @GWWonkcast. Send us love letters and hate mail. Email us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher. Our editors are Eric Ledoux and Eli Richmond, with music by Pele Gunther.